Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is the podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and one thing that they'd like to forget, something they want to bury in the ground and never think of again. My guest in this episode of My Time Capsule is Professor Chris Lintott. Chris is the presenter of the BBC's long-running Sky at Night programme, and he's recently been appointed the 39th Professor of Astronomy at Gresham College in London, an extraordinary place founded in 1597 to bring new learning to Londoners. And astronomy has been one of the seven chairs from the start. At the same time, Chris is Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Oxford and a research fellow at New College. His research now ranges from understanding how galaxies form and evolve, through using machine learning to find the most unusual things in the universe, to predicting the properties of visiting interstellar asteroids. That old thing, you know. He is principal investigator of the Zooniverse citizen science platform, which provides opportunities for more than 2 million online volunteers to contribute to scientific research, and which was the topic of his first book, The Crowd and the Cosmos. Chris describes himself as a distractible astronomer who specializes in galaxy formation, machine learning, including anomaly detection, and occasional planet hunting. Yeah, I describe myself pretty much the same way. His latest book, Our Accidental Universe, Stories of Discovery from Asteroids to Aliens, is a tour of the key astronomical events of the past century, and of all the accidents and human error involved in our pursuit of asteroids, radio waves, new stars, and alien life. He's also written books with the great Patrick Moore, who he first worked with on The Sky at Night, which they co-presented until Patrick's sad death in 2012, and with the Queen guitarist and astrophysicist Brian May, including Bang, The Complete History of the Universe, and Cosmic Tourist. So will Professor Chris Lintott choose five things of an astronomical nature to put in his time capsule, or, like everyone else, are there other things that are equally important to him? Well, here's our chance to find out as we hear the five things from his life Chris would put in his time capsule. I don't do that waiting room thing. I like people to feel they have the power to just come in when they choose.
And to leave.
Yes, quite. Yes. If I say anything that you go, oh, the man's an idiot, which yeah, I think it's likely.
I don't think so. It's all good.
It's all good.
My favourite question so far in the last few weeks has been, but why haven't you found the aliens? Which seemed unnecessarily aggressive, really. But, you know, we do our best.
You should have asked. I've got some here.
Well, indeed. Yeah, they've been on most people's podcasts, I know. So.
But I was going to start by asking you immediately, so you know, I always get drawn to these things in the headlines of newspapers. Today, apparently, there's been a great astrocome breakthrough. And I read about it. I haven't the faintest idea what they're talking about.
Brilliantly, you're ahead of me.
So
I've been in student meetings all morning. So yes, so you can tell me about it, and I can try and.
Well, apparently, it's they can detect an area of light that would reveal changes in the suns that they're looking at, and therefore reveal the possibility of wider orbit planets going around them, and therefore be able to find more planets that are possible Earth-like planets.
Yeah, well, this is a game that people have been playing for a while. It's the great adventure of astronomy at the minute, is the discovery that planets are really common, that the universe conspires, and it turns out it likes making planets. So if you go outside and look up, then every star you see probably has a solar system. But we're biased about which ones we can see. It's easier to detect big planets and big planets close to their stars. So if you put a Jupiter where Mercury is, it's easy in our solar system. But Earths are harder and things further out are harder. So we're always trying to refine our techniques to try and catch smaller, more subtle signals.
Well, I'm delighted to be able to tell you that astrocombs have broken through.
This is good news. Yes, I think this is a method where, because you can't see the planets directly, not because they're too faint, but because the star is too bright.
Right.
It's like trying to spot a glow fly as it flies in front of a stadium floodlight, which is pretty tricky. Not that I've ever tried it myself, but one assumes it would be difficult. And so what we do is we look at the effect on the star, and the method you're talking about involves looking at the wobble of the star. So as the planet goes round, it's pulled by the star's gravity, but the planet also pulls the star about. So as the Earth orbits the sun will wobble back and forth.
A tiny amount.
That's right. Yeah, it's about walking speed. So if you put it's about a meter per second. So if you imagine trying to look at a star and measure how it's moving to the precision of about a meter per second, it's really, really difficult.
It's
amazing. The people who do this have great patience and need new instruments like this astrocomb.
Exactly, yes. I think it's a telescope in Chile.
That's right, and it's the thing you sit on the back of it. But this is the great venture because, 20 years ago, we didn't know that planets were common. It was possible we lived in a rare solar system. And now we know we've got a galaxy full of worlds to explore.
Amazing.
And pretty much everything that science fiction writers have dreamt of turns out to exist. So, star with two suns in its sky, tick, we've done that. Yeah. Planet that orbits so close to the star, it's perpetually molten. Yep, we've got that. We've got double planets. We've got all sorts of things. We haven't found, the only thing we're missing, I think, is we haven't really found moons yet, because that's trickier still. Mm. So we don't yet know whether moons are common, and we might come back to that in a bit.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to talk also about your book, which I think looks absolutely fascinating, Our Accidental Universe. The title catches me immediately, but also there's a phrase used in the publication which I think sums up what you do. It's that they build the Hubble telescope. They spend $1 billion building the Hubble telescope. They put it in space and they say, where are you going to point it? Well, what are we going to look at? And they say, nothing.
Yes, absolutely nothing. In fact, the biggest nothing that we can find. So in fact, a small patch of sky just above the plough, which people might know how to find, where there's absolutely nothing. And this was hugely controversial because you've spent a lot of money on this telescope and it had its problems. There were problems with the mirror early on that had to be corrected with a space shuttle mission to go and fix things.
Yeah.
And then you say, we want to point at nothing, not just quickly, but for 100 hours, which is a long time. And the idea here is that you want to see the faintest possible things. So if you stare at the same patch of sky, leave your camera exposure open, then what you can do is you detect the faintest possible galaxies. And when they did this, slightly to everyone's surprise, actually, that patch of nothing transformed into a field of tens of thousands of galaxies. And they're far enough away that their light had been traveling towards us for 12 billion years, so for most of the age of the universe. And so this is it's actually appropriately enough for this podcast. It's a way of getting a time capsule. We actually get to the great problem of being an astronomer is that I can't reach out and turn round and touch and alter any of the things I study. But the compensation is we get to see the past. So by looking at this ancient light, we get to actually see what the universe was like back when it was young. And this was a remarkable observation. And
it's how your brain goes around it. That's what I can't understand, is how sometimes it's when you look at it, the enormousness of it, the vastness of it all, and the scale of it is so huge that in a way you'd have to shrink it down into a human story, don't you?
That's right. And I think one of the motivations for writing the book was that I think we may have given the impression that as astronomers, you know, with people like Brian Cox, who I'm a big fan of, but, you know, when Brian speaks, I think people think that he somehow has an intuitive understanding of what it is to live in a universe with 100 billion galaxies. And I promise you, he doesn't. None of us do.
No.
We're as impressed, sometimes overwhelmed, awestruck by the size of the cosmos ourselves. But one of the things I write about in the book is I think that can be freeing as well. It doesn't have to be a scary thing. After all, you know, if you've had a bad day at work, standing looking at the stars, realizing that, you know, we're just on one planet of several hundred billion, that there may be other worlds and other life out there. I think that can be a reassuring thing, I think. It puts earthly problems in perspective, yeah.
Yeah, I've always found it reassuring. I've always thought how extraordinary. Well, the thing that I remember telling my son once, sitting in a garden in France, I was a bit drunk, Chris, obviously.
Yeah, that does help.
It goes along with sitting in a garden in France at night, you know. So I'm staring up at the stars, and he said, it's a bit overwhelming, isn't it? And I said, well, actually, I think it's quite a compliment. The very fact that we are seeing the light from those stars, and they've been travelling all that time, and their journey ends at the back of our eye.
Yeah, by chance, really.
Amazing,
that you happened to be there. And I think, these early galaxies, I think about that Hubble Space Telescope image, that there'd been light from similar galaxies streaming past the Earth for all of its existence. Mm-hmm. And then we happen to live at the time when we've learnt to put a mirror in space to catch it. And there's something really, really lovely about that. And it makes me think every photon that we capture is precious. So,
yes,
you know, being able to look at this is important.
I agree with you completely. I think you should see it as a real compliment. The fact that we've got to the point, we've developed to the point where we're cognitive enough and we understand the world enough to recognize what we're seeing.
Yeah, I think I quote in the book my favourite science fiction author, who's a writer called Olaf Stapledon, who was a Oxford Marxist philosopher in the 1930s, who also wrote science fiction, because, you know, why not?
Yeah.
And he wrote an extraordinary book called First and Last Men, which nearly made it into my time capsule, actually, because it's a history of the next 5 billion years. And he has this idea that intelligence rises and falls in the course of human history. Mm. And each time it's very different. And so the book is a story of how we experience the cosmos. And really it's about savoring those precious moments of intelligence when we're awake and can see the cosmos. But, you know, not all the stories end well. There's, you know, there's the adventure where they build an advanced supercomputer, which then decides it's more important than any of the people who built it, but then eventually decides it has no poetry in its soul and shuts itself down. There's the story where the birdmen of Venus decide that they should fly into their doom because that would be the most noble and beautiful thing for them to. It's quite an extraordinary book, since you're getting the idea. But yes, it's this sense of capturing, of rejoicing in the fact that we get to be surprised by and enjoy this cosmos while we can.
Yeah. Well, if anything came out of the First World War, it was the way people thought in the 1930s.
That's right. And I should say, if you do read First and Last Men, listener, if you are listening, skip the first 100 pages are a Marxist analysis of early 20th century politics. And, you know, that has its own academic interest, but I strongly urge you to start on about page 120.
When he goes off on a whimsy. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. We much prefer the whimsical bits.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to talk to you about the things that you want to put into time capsule and see where that leads us, Chris, because I have so many questions about, you know, how on earth did you get onto Sky at Night at such a young age? What was Patrick Moore like? All those sort of things. But hopefully something like that will come out as we talk. So let's see what you're going to put in and find out more about you from those. What's number one?
Well, when you ask an astronomer about a time capsule, I think it's impossible not to think about what we've already sent out into space. There have been attempts to create time capsules, ostensibly often because there's some sense that alien civilizations in the future might find these things, but really as pieces of art, as to try and represent what we are. The most famous of them is the Voyager Golden Records, which are LPs with groove blinds engraved on them that contain some photos representing life on Earth, but also famously some sounds, some choice music, and a message from Richard Nixon. So that's nice.
That's the only recording he's proud of.
Well, maybe, yeah. It's his signature on the plaque on the moon as well. So, wow. You know, he's left a mark. So there were huge arguments at the time about what to put on this record. There's some attempt to include non-Western music. There was a lot of controversy about putting Chuck Berry on the record.
Right.
Because do we really want to be represented by rock music in the cosmos? So my first thing is a piece of music which isn't on the record, but is inspired by it. So there's a biologist called Lewis Thomas who was asked what he thought should go on the record. And he said, it's very simple. We should merely send into the cosmos the entire works of Bach. But that would be boasting. And I think that there's something lovely in the fact that that's what human civilization produced. So I'd like to preserve the Bach cello suites, please. Now, they have a particular place in my heart. So, you know, we could use the biologist's recommendation, but I grew up in a slightly odd household musically. My parents are both deaf, and this isn't a joke. My dad's profoundly deaf, and he liked Cliff Richard and Rodger and Hammerstein musicals. So you can fill in your own punchline there. But it wasn't a hugely musical household. And so I came to music much later, I think, than I would have done otherwise. And in particular, classical music, I never really understood until I think I was about 16. And on BBC Two, there were a series of films, I think on Thursday evenings, made by the cellist Yo-Yo Ma, where he took each of these beautiful cello suites, which are these remarkable pieces for single cello that sound, at least sounded to my untrained ear, like there's a whole orchestra playing, but it's just one man and a cello. And each of them, he collaborated with a different artist to do something extraordinary. There's a Torvald Lundin one. Wow. There's a strange film about landscaping outside Boston City Hall, but there's a couple of others that really stuck. And it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And it just stopped me. I happened to catch the first one. And I just sat there dumbfounded that this music existed. Mm. And it's my sort of alien encounter with this world of classical music that, you know, you hear a bit of at school, but hadn't really struck me. And that set me off on a lifetime love of all sorts of music, really. And they're still putting that recording, the Yo-Yo Ma recording of the Bach cello suites on. If I'm having a bad day or I need just to be quiet, I'll just put that on, and it's still my safe space to come back to. And it goes very well with sitting in the back garden with a glass of wine and a clear sky. So yeah, I'll have the Bach cello suites, please.
Absolutely fantastic. It's strange, isn't it? I feel sorry for people who have not included classical music into the music they love, because everybody can love a piece of rock and roll. Everybody can love the Beatles and all those songs that you grew up with. But if you never discover that moment of hearing a piece of classical music and going, oh my God, this is extraordinary, then you're really missing out. I remember seeing an Andre Previn program where he described the writing by Beethoven of the Ninth Symphony in great detail, following through his letters that he was writing to people at the time talking about it. And he demonstrated moments where Beethoven had inspiration. So the moment where somebody starts to sing in it is quite extraordinary, because it goes very late in it. And it's almost as if he'd run out of ideas. He didn't know what to do next.
And it's even like the line is something like, not these sad songs, let's sing something else as well.
Right,
so he's even acknowledging that it's this change as we gradually. It's another of my favourite pieces. It's interesting what you say about people encountering or including classical music, because I'm interested in all sorts of sort of music. You know, I grew up on West Country punk and things like that, which is a whole other story. But probably I decided did not need to be sent into space or recorded in a time capsule. But I was talking to, I have the great privilege to be Gresham Professor of Astronomy at Gresham College in London, which is an institution that's given free lectures essentially on the same seven subjects since the 16th century.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? The length of that is amazing.
It's a great thing, yeah. But there's a Professor of Astronomy. Mm-hmm. There's a professor of music who's currently Milton Mercades, who's a jazz musician, and he's an amazing lecturer. And we were just talking the other night about the fact that there's this study that shows, there's a well-known set of studies that shows that the music you like best tends to be what you listen to when you're about 14.
Right.
So if you think of that nostalgia, the music that people tend to be comfortable with, it tends to be there. But we were talking about it, and it's not true for everyone. It's not true, I think, for people who have music as a large part of their lives. Because there's then a sense that you keep exploring and you keep questing and so on. And so the Bach, for me, was the trigger to listen very widely, to spin the radio and listen to different stations, to go and hear. It inspired me to go and hear live classical music and later opera for the first time. And yeah, so I think you need that goad to get out of your comfort zone with music, I think.
Yeah, the little push, don't you? I've been lucky enough in my career to stand in the middle of orchestras and narrate.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
Surrounded by these musicians of extraordinary skill who are all, in a way, bizarrely, accompanying me. And that is just, I find it overwhelming that such a group of talented people should be concentrating on my spoken word. Chris, it's absolutely thrilling.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of that with, I have a friend, Steve Pretty, who runs the Hackney Colliery Band. He's a jazz trumpeter of great skill. And so we actually have a stage show that we perform where I explain astronomy to him and he explains jazz to me, which is fun. But we've done a few pieces where he improvises underneath me speaking. And it's extraordinary to me that, especially because he comes from a jazz tradition, he's very happy to just follow my lead.
Mm.
And it's terrifying, fun, but terrifying. Although I must tell you the story, the first time we did this, it was in a little theatre in Oxford, first time we tried the show out.
Mm.
And our big finale was going to be me describing the inevitable heat death of the universe, the period billions of years hence when all the stars have faded and we're left with a sea of radiation and particles expanding forever into nothingness, but really laying it on thick. And Steve was playing underneath. And the idea was that we would sort of end the universe and then kick into Do What You Wanna and have some New Orleans second line to finish the show, which I thought was quite a good idea. But unfortunately, what happened was there was a problem with the robotic drummer that Steve had brought with him. And so what happened was we ended the show on describing the heat death of the universe with mournful trumpet underneath, stopped, and then the audience filed out silently and left us just standing there awkwardly. So, yeah, not really what we were going for.
No.
The heat death of the universe is a while away, I should say.
Yes.
So you've got plenty of time to enjoy music before then.
Well, while you're in front of me, is that entropy?
Yeah, that's the winding down of things. Uh-huh. Yeah, one of the great mysteries of physics is that the universe started with reserves of entropy, which is sort of how ordered things are. And so we've had the ability to create stars and so on. If you created a universe randomly, then you'd more or less expect to start with randomly scattered gas and light and radiation. But yet we live in this universe where there's structure and stars, and we live at a time when that's true. So that's a really fundamental mystery. We've really no idea. That's about how the Big Bang actually works. And there we're sort of in theoretical speculation.
Mm. Well, and leaves it open to people who say, well, I know how it worked. Yes.
Well, I get letters from them and they're very welcome to send me theories. But we're working on it is probably the best thing.
Quite. Well, indeed, that's always the thing that scientists say, is that you say we're working on it.
Yeah.
And we will continue to work on it. And things that we think now, if we find they're wrong, we'll accept they're wrong and we'll tell you why. But that's a joyous thing.
And that's the fun. Yeah, exactly. That's the fun part. I think people think that the fun part is being clever or appearing clever. And actually the fun part is where we don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I will mention the book every so often, but it was written partly, it's about surprise in the universe, and it's partly trying to deconstruct the myth that we know what we're doing.
Yes.
And to give a sense of some of the fun that we have where we are surprised or caught out or where things don't make sense.
Yes, well, the excitement is there are some things we know, but there are loads of things we don't. That's why it's worth looking at.
Yeah, and it's a big universe full of them as well, so that's fun.
Fantastic. Well, I think, yes, Bach. I think the cello suites, absolutely, let's put them in.
Good.
Good. Okay, what's number two, Chris?
Well, I thought I should have some astronomy in here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was trying to think how we should preserve our current state of knowledge of the universe. And I'm an observer, so I'm somebody who thinks about how to look at the universe and how to use telescopes and how to do it. But I realized, actually, fundamentally, I'm doing something very old-fashioned, which is that we're mapping the universe. And cultures for hundreds of years, thousands of years, have mapped the night sky. And if you go to the Ashmolean or the British Museum, then you find centuries of attempts to map the sky. So what I'd like to propose as a second thing in our time capsule is our current best map of the local universe.
Right.
And it was made by a project called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, who built a telescope in New Mexico that did an extraordinary thing. So normally when you have a telescope, you spend your life choosing what to look at. You send it whizzing around the sky from object to object. And Sloan did the opposite. What they did was they just pointed it at the sky and then night after night allowed the sky to turn over it and just recorded whatever crossed its camera. And so it recorded something like 20 billion objects, most of them stars. And so we have their positions in the sky. And then on the clearest nights, it went back to about a million of them, which were identified as galaxies, so systems of stars like our own Milky Way, and it recorded their distance. So this is a three-dimensional map of the universe, and you can fly through it. We can see that there is structure, that there are places where there are great cities of galaxies, great superclusters, and there are places where there are very, very few galaxies at all, what we call cosmic voids. And this whole thing adds up to a cosmic web. But this is, I think, if we could preserve one astronomical artifact from the early 21st century so that whoever finds the capsule could work out what we knew about the universe, I think rather than giving them the answers, I don't want to give them a book of equations. I want to give them the data. And from here, I think you could work out that the universe was expanding and, in fact, speeding up. I think you could work out something about how Milky Way came to be. And you could work out from this data some of the story of the lives of the stars. So you'd get the history of the sun and our solar system. So I think, you know, this is cosmology in a package, but it's also beautiful. Mm. And I think if we can preserve it in a way such that perhaps we can see this 3D structure, this vast cosmic web, that would be very satisfying.
Astonishing to look at that structure from the outside of it. That's amazing, isn't it? It's sort of absurd, really, because you could never get outside of it. And yet we are able to show it as this is what it would look like if you stood back.
Yes, that's right. And you could jump galaxies, which is fun. I've done this on a computer. So you could look at the night sky or the galactic sky as it would look from any other galaxy. And you realize that the pattern always looks roughly the same. It's a fundamental principle of cosmology that where you are in the universe doesn't matter. But of course, the details are different. Your view, if we lived in a galaxy in one of these big superclusters, the sky would be alive, not with stars, but with other galaxies. If we lived in a void, it's interesting to think about how far we would have got with our science. Would we have understood that the Milky Way was a galaxy, or would we perhaps believe all that there was in the universe?
Yes.
Yeah, so I think it allows that flight of fancy as well, but it's also a huge amount of scientific data that we've been working on for about 20 years and still haven't exhausted.
Is this the project where individuals can get involved?
Yes. So one of my story with Sloan is that we wanted to understand how the individual galaxies had evolved. And one example of what we were trying to work out was whether their surroundings made much difference. So it's a bit like asking whether people who live in a city behave differently from people who live in the country. So we were trying to do that with galaxies. And with a galaxy, because we've got pictures of each of them, we can work out their shape. And the shape of a galaxy tells you about how it's changed over billions of years. So whether it's interacted with other galaxies, where it's formed stars, all of that information is encoded in the shape of the galaxy. And when we started this in 2006, it became apparent that what we needed to do was look at all of these galaxies. There was a student called Kevin Schwinski who looked at 50,000 of them and showed that he was better than a computer back then at doing this. And so he wasn't very keen to look at another 950,000, which, you know, I could understand. And my boss wasn't keen to give me 20 more students to go through the data. And so without really thinking about it, we put them online on a project called Galaxy Zoo, which you can still go to. And suddenly tens of thousands of people jumped into the site and got good at helping us sort through these galaxies. And
they
found some extraordinary things. And that grew into this platform, which we run called Zooniverse, which has about 200 projects where scientists or other researchers need help from anyone to sort through their data. So you can go and in the space of a couple of minutes, you can go from not knowing anything to making a real contribution to scientific research via these platforms. And it's been great fun.
Absolutely incredible. It's a fantastic thing, isn't it, to look at those galaxies and the number of them, the scale of it. I find it astonishingly exciting.
When we started Galaxy Zoo, one of the things we thought was engaging was that it was true that in the first couple of weeks on the site, anyone who went and participated was the first person in human history to see that galaxy.
Of course.
And that's still true. We're now using data from the more distant universe. But if you go today to galaxyzoo.org, the odds are you could be the first person ever to see a galaxy, which is quite an extraordinary thought. really. I'm not sure quite what to do with the thought, but it's an interesting...
I mean, that would draw people in, wouldn't it? That would draw me
in. I think so, yeah.
The idea that not only am I looking at a galaxy and being the first human who's ever seen it, but also I'm looking at something from 11, 10 billion years ago.
That's right, and we're sort of writing our own history that way. Yeah. So it's proved very useful, and people have participated. And one of the useful things is that while we have a lot of people sorted through the data, that's very useful, but we should have realized that people are infinitely distractible. And this is a good thing, because it means where we found really unusual objects, then our volunteers have been able to draw our attention to them. And sometimes they're just fun. There's a galaxy that looks exactly like a penguin sitting on an egg, and that's kind of pleasing. But sometimes they turn out to be really interesting objects. There's a set of small, round, green galaxies, which the volunteers called the peas, which turn out to be the most efficient factories of stars anywhere in the universe.
Right.
And so these are galaxies that, for some reason, they live in the middle of nowhere. For some reason, they've suddenly decided to turn all their gas into stars. And we're 10 years into studying these things and still don't know why it's happening. But they came from the fact that volunteers were able to spot that these things looked unusual. They'd been hiding in the data since the 50s, but we needed people to look at the data to tell us what was interesting.
Because even space follows those rules of nature, really, don't they? It follows the rules of nature in the sense that if something is working properly, it is of a certain shape.
That's the idea. Yeah, exactly.
So when they're not those shapes, there's always a reason. It might be black holes, it might be whatever. But
or interactions between galaxies. You get these when galaxies collide, you get these spectacular long tails of stars or shells of material, but they encode the history, you're right. Mm. So it's really sort of writing down the gravitational history of these galaxies.
Yes.
We've now got to the point where computers can help with the task. So we now run projects where computers work alongside the volunteers. So the computers do the boring galaxies, and then we have our volunteers look at the really interesting, unusual stuff, where, as you say, some physical process has caused something unusual to happen.
Mm, how fantastic. Right, okay, that's the second thing going in there. So what's number three, Chris? Okay, right, pretty bloody fascinating so far, isn't he? We'll be back after these ads to hear the rest of Chris's time capsule items. Don't go flipping.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. Thanks for the lack of flipping. Unless you happen to be listening to this episode on Pancake Day in the UK, in which case, get ready to flip if you don't want them to burn. For everyone else, here is the rest of my chat with Professor Chris Lintott. No sugar and a bit of lemon on mine, thanks.
So number three is, I think, we'll stick to astronomy, but I think is the other end of astronomy for me. So I grew up as an amateur astronomer. I grew up as somebody who loved looking at the sky, literally standing in the back garden with binoculars sometimes, but learning the constellations and looking at the sky. And I've always been an advocate of what I'd call lazy astronomy. So I meet people for whom seeing a really good dark sky is on their bucket list. It's something they want to do once. Maybe they want to travel to New Zealand or to northern Norway to see the aurora or whatever. But astronomy can also be part of your life all the time. You know, even if you live in a city, if you go outside and look up, you can notice at the minute, for example, that Jupiter is low in the west. It's the first bright thing that appears. And if you come out in a month's time, it will have sunk down into the twilight because of the Earth's motion around the sun. And we watch the phases of the moon change. And everyone's had the experience of seeing a spectacular full moon rising and then noticing a week later that it's only a half moon and so on. So I think there's something to be gained from enjoying the sky in this sort of lazy fashion. And so I was tempted to put in something grand and gorgeous, like, you know, the Palomar 200-inch telescope, which discovered that the universe was expanding. But no, I actually want a telescope I could look through. So I'm going to put in, this is for my use, really, the little reflecting telescope that I've had since I was a kid, which I earned the money for by selling ice cream on Torquay Harbour seafront for a couple of summers when I was a kid at school. And what I love about it is that it's the simplest possible thing. It has no drive, it has no motor, it has no computing, but you can plonk it down, swing it round, and be looking at Jupiter 30 seconds later. And I must have spent thousands of hours at the eyepiece, enjoying the planets, enjoying some of my favourite objects, and sort of just keeping an eye on the sky. And so I think that, I'm assuming, I don't know what your scenario is, so I don't know who's digging up this time capsule. But
that's very much up to you, I think.
I think it's essential that a telescope you look through is preserved.
Yes.
It's interesting because, you know, other people, other professional astronomers have a very different relationship. They're sort of escaped physicists, and many of them have never looked through a telescope. But for me, this quest to understand the universe comes from enjoying looking at it.
I love the description of an astronomer as, you know, what do you do? I just stare for a living.
Right, exactly.
It's a beautiful way to describe your job, I think.
Yeah, and wait for things to happen. But but the universe provides, and these cycles which repeat, you know, we've got Comet Pons-Brooks I was looking at last night in a freezing cold night, actually, in Oxford. But Pons-Brooks comes back every 71 years, so I've never seen it before. I shall probably never see it again. It wasn't spectacular. It occasionally has nice outbursts, but at the minute it's sitting there as a faint, fuzzy blob. But it was fun to track it down and see it and think about the journey it's gone on since it was last the centre of people's attention. And so doing that sort of thing is great fun.
I think that's why people are fascinated by Halley's Comet.
That's right, yeah.
Because you go, well, this is something I might see twice in my life, possibly.
That's right. So it's a human scale, right? So it comes around. And comets are always fascinating because they're unpredictable. You know, the joke is that they're very much like cats in that they have tails and minds of their own. And so, yeah, with a comet, because these things are icy, dirty snowballs, really, they come into the inner solar system, they heat up, and the ice is exposed to heat and creates gas, which then stretches out into these wonderful tails. But that process is complicated. It's like, I don't know, if you tried to roast something in your oven, try to predict exactly which bit is going to blacken first or whatever. Not sounding like a very good cook, but you know what I mean. You know, the details of this are really tricky. So you never quite know what's going to happen with a comet. There have been spectacular comets in the past that have broken up and put on a brilliant show and then failed to reappear. There have been certainly our share of damp squibs where people have got very excited. There's actually a big comet coming in that's due at the end of this year that people are quite excited about. But until it gets into the inner solar system, we've no idea whether it will be, you know, storybook bright, brilliant, go outside, look up. It's brilliant, or whether it will be a faint blob like Pons-Brooks. And actually, Halley in 1986, I've got it, which was the last pass, I've got a memory of going outside with my parents to try and look for it. Now, it wasn't visible to the naked eye very easily in 86. It didn't come very close to the Earth, so we can't have seen it. But I have this memory of I remember being dragged outside to try and see this comet. So it's almost my first astronomical memory. And we're halfway. Halley just passed through aphelion, the point where it's furthest from the sun. So it's on its way back. And 38 years, we should have quite a good view.
Lovely. I look forward to that. Well, I'm going to put that telescope in, obviously.
Good. Excellent.
And I think you're right. I think if somebody opened this and saw that, you would automatically put it to your eye.
I think so.
Or, you know, multiple eyes. Who knows?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's hope that if it's an alien species finding this, that they view the same wavelengths as us, so it will make some use to them.
I'm going to put it with a little note saying, whatever you do, don't go to Chris's house for Sunday lunch. He's a terrible cook.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay, so we've got two left, Chris. We've got one you want to keep and one you'd like to bury.
Should we do the last good one first, I think?
Yeah, okay.
Because I think the second one might be controversial. So, yeah, I couldn't not include my other great obsession. So we've done music and mm-hmm. we've done astronomy and we've criticised my food. So you've got most of my life together. But I am an obsessed devotee of the game of real tennis.
Right.
So I would like to request, if not a whole court, then at least a racket, balls, and the rules of real tennis, which is, I don't know if you know, the original version of the sport.
Yes.
So it's something of a time capsule itself. We still play with the same rules that Henry VIII would have played with at Hampton Court. And so keeping this game alive, which is far superior to the modern lawn tennis, is very important. So if I can keep it in the time capsule and know that other people will pick this up and play, that would be very satisfying.
You've commentated on it, haven't you?
I have. I've got to do a couple of world championships, which
wow.
is amazing. So most recently I did the ladies world championship, which was great fun. But before that, I did the final day of the men's world championship between the two best players the sport's ever seen. And this is the oldest world championship in sport. It goes back to the early 18th century, and it's maintained roughly the same format in that the champion is challenged by the next best player. And it has this extraordinary format. So I guess you need to know that the game is scores like lawn tennis. So you have sets, first to mm-hmm. six for a set. And it's immensely tactical. But the championship is played over 3 days. It's best of 13 sets. So you play four sets, then you have a day off, then you play four sets, then you have a day off, and then you play this last day. And what that means is you play your first third of the match, and then you can go away and train, you can think, you can come back with new tactics. And on each day of this match, the players came back and changed completely how they were playing to try and outthink their opponent. And I found myself commentating on day three, which was this remarkable. The defending champion, Rob Fay, was over 50 at the time. So it's a game of guile that rewards an older player, which is another reason it's fun to play. And he was clinging on against a young American challenger, Camden Riviere. And it was just great fun. And probably the hardest thing I've ever done on a microphone because you had to watch very intently. And, you know, I had an expert with me, but it was... it was tricky, but great fun. You can find it on YouTube and try and understand the intricacies.
I wonder why it's not on television. It strikes me that anything that is tactical is always interesting to watch.
I think it's quite hard. It's changed recently just in the last couple of years, but at least for the last 20 years, it's very hard to film. So the game is played in a particular court, and the court has features that are derived from, we think, an Italian medieval street. So there are penthouses, sloping roofs, which are supposed to be shop awnings. There are windows you can hit, some of which ring bells and some of which score points. Think pinball machine. And so there isn't really anywhere very easy to put a television camera. Now we've got miniature cameras that can sit and be put in various bits of the court. We're able to stream the games, and it's actually gaining a following online.
So it may well happen.
I think so.
It's rather like squash was, for a long time, was this amazing game. But you just can only watch it from the back. Now with all the, you can watch it from different angles.
That's right. And squash is an interesting comparison because obviously they're derived from the same source. So squash came from rackets, which came from tennis originally. But squash, I think, is a great game if you're athletic and if you're exactly the same standard as the person you're playing. Whereas, I have to say, real tennis is a game that can be played more slowly. The balls move fast, but it's a bigger court and it's much more tactical. So there's actually, for me, I'm, you know, in my mid-40s now, and it's amazing to be playing a sport that I'm still getting better at because I'm still learning the game, whereas on the squash court or badminton court, these days I can be run rings around. But with tennis, that's not quite how it works.
That's very appealing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But there's also this, just the fact it's this culture, you know, in Shakespeare's Henry V, there's a whole speech about the rules of tennis. We've got things like, you know, the stories of Henry VIII. A couple of French kings died coming off court, one because he was too exhausted and drank a pint of cold wine, which caused some sort of hemorrhage, I believe. So, you know, this is the oldest sporting tradition that still exists. It's a brilliant game, and there are only about 40 courts in the world. And so I think this needs preserving. And so I'm hoping by putting a court into your very capacious time capsule, that will help.
Very large, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But as we know, space is a variable thing.
Good. Yes, that's true. I'm sure we can fold one up. Do you know what? We can even use the Oxford courts, which is the smallest in the world.
Right.
And has various quirky features that suit my game. So people hate coming to play here. So we'll compromise and we'll have the smallest court.
Lovely. Okay, let's put that in. That's fantastic. So we've just got the one thing that you'd like to bury and forget.
Yeah. Now, this isn't going to be popular, I think. I'd like to get rid of the moon, please. Mm. And I want to start by acknowledging that it has been useful to us in the past. It does stabilize the Earth's axis so that our climate yes. doesn't change. And you can even argue that the fact that it produces these tides may have played an important role in life coming onto the land. And it does reduce the number of asteroids that hit us and produce beautiful solar eclipses. I'm actually off to hopefully see the total solar eclipse in a couple of weeks' time. But it has to go because it gets in the way of astronomy.
It's too bright.
It's exactly so. So much of the astronomy I need to do professionally is limited by the presence of this most natural source of light pollution in the sky. We have whole weeks of each month where we can't look at the sky properly. And I'm afraid it's just inefficient. And, you know, I see there are other moons in the solar system, many of which are more interesting than ours, which is a lifeless rock. So I see no reason why it couldn't be disposed of. And I think this would be a boon to astronomers everywhere. And I'm not sure we'd miss it in the short term. Over millions of years, as the Earth's axis started to wobble, I think, I agree that's a problem. But, you know, in the short term, I think it would help me. So, yeah, I'd like to destroy the moon, please.
Okay, that seems only reasonable.
Well, you very much had the tone of somebody pacifying somebody who'd stop them in the street.
A madman in the street with a knife.
Yeah, madman in the street going, I want to get rid of the moon.
Yes, of course you do, sir.
Yes, well done. Carry on.
Put your arms in here. That's it. Well, there are certain reasons I can see for doing it as well, because I find it slightly worrying that, well, one, that independent, wealthy people are suddenly talking about going to the moon. I find that disturbing. Also, that nations are now once again competing for it as if it were a resource rather than a thing of wonder.
Yes, there's a company last week announced, fairly far-fetched, but still, plans to strip mine the moon to looking for helium-3, which is a substance of vaguely limited use at the minute. Use it for refrigerating and quantum computing, perhaps. But yeah, there's this sense of, actually, in general, in space, I think we're back in a world in which we're talking about space as a resource, as something to be mined, to be exploited, and exploited by individuals and countries. I do find that worrying. I find it quite, as somebody who grew up as a fan of space, of thrilling to space shuttle launches and being excited about the potential of expanding in space, it's quite hard now to watch another rocket launch with 20 of Elon Musk's satellites, which pollute the night sky and so on, without having had a conversation about who should do that. So yes, maybe the moon removes temptation.
Yeah.
This is not a reason I thought of. I'd be glorying in the fact people have talked about mining asteroids as well. And one of the reasons you might want to do that is that there are some very platinum-rich asteroids in the asteroid belt. So if you could get one, in theory, you'd be the wealthiest person on Earth, except that the moment you did that, there'd be so much platinum, its price would crash. So you have to go and get an asteroid secretly and very slowly.
Slowly, like filtering it out.
That's right, yeah. So there's an economic problem to be solved. But yeah, no, I like that. That's another reason to get rid of the moon, and I shall add that to my list on my frequent campaigns to do this.
Okay, Chris, well, I'm willing for you to put it in. I apologise to all surfers, obviously.
Yes, indeed.
Because they're all going to be standing around on a board.
Well, you'd still have some tides from the sun. So, there would still be some tides. So we've made surfing easier is what we've done.
Mm. And the night sky would be all the more beautiful.
I think so. Yeah, less disrupted.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, there you are. I think you've got a most extraordinary career, and it's fascinating to listen to you whenever you talk. And I look forward to reading Our Accidental Universe, If I'm an American, that's called, what are you going to call it there?
It's called Accidental Astronomy in the States, and it's out in June there. So the everywhere else you can get hold of it now, and in the US, it's just being polished and printed as we speak.
Marvellous. Fantastic. Well, I hope everybody goes out and buys it. It looks fantastic. Chris, it's been really lovely of you to give me your time. Thank you.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it. Great.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Chris Lintott. Many thanks to Chris for being my guest. I look forward to reading his book, and if you'd like to do the same, then there's a link in the description of this episode to it. There's also a link to Acast Plus, where for a small monthly fee, you can get this podcast ad and sponsorship ad free, plus a bonus podcast every week, My Time Capsule, The Debrief, which you might enjoy. Some people do. Please do all the things that most podcasts ask you to do, that is, click on 5 stars to rate this podcast highly, or even leave a comment or review, and do subscribe to get all episodes as they're released. You don't have to listen to them all, but they'll be available when and if you want to. Of course, I'm on social media in various forms, and so is My Time Capsule. So do search us out and follow us. Again, there are links in the description. And of course, if you're interested in big cats, there's a links in the description. Which is more of a spelling joke, really, but it's still worth doing, I think. The ominous silence suggests otherwise. Okay, if you're a fan of silence, then you won't be interested in the fact that you can listen to and download the theme tune written and performed by Pastor P's music from Spotify. This was a cast-off production for Acast, a very good company to choose if you're looking to put out a podcast. It was skillfully produced, as ever, by John Fenton Stevens. Right, time to clear out some cupboards. Every single one in my house is rammed with stuff I haven't even looked at or used for 20 years. Space, eh? The final frontier. Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.